The following program is a PodcastOne.com production. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse, unscripted. Now, here's your host, John Horn.
Hello and welcome to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Today we're going to talk with the actor Alfred Molina. You've seen him in some big budget Hollywood films. He's also done a lot of work on stage. Alfred Molina coming up next on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. But before we talk with Alfred, we want to take a second to talk about one of our sponsors who brings you this show for free. Alone is back for its fourth season, but this time around, the rules have changed. 10 hardcore survivalists will still be dropped into the unforgiving wilderness, but that is where the similarities with previous seasons end. These 10 participants are comprised of 5 competing teams, brothers, fathers, and sons, and a married couple who all have unbreakable bonds. The competitors will be split apart and dropped off as individuals, equipped with their 10 items, 5 each. In order to win the game, they must mobilize, find each other, and survive on the island together, longer than the other competing pairs. They will face extreme isolation and psychological distress, both individually and together, as they plunge into the unknown, self-documenting their experiences along the way. Can they work together, or will the strength of their bond crumble beneath the anvil of Mother Nature? At stake is $500,000 awarded to the team that can last the longest. This season also brings viewers back to North Vancouver Island, where the threat of predators is fiercer than last season, and the weather is the harshest they've seen yet. So be sure to tune in to new episodes of Alone, Thursdays at 10, 9 Central, only on History.
Now back to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
We're joined now by actor and producer Alfred Molina.
Well, hello.
Welcome to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, I want to start with a story, and it's a true story, and it was the first time I saw you on stage. It was 1998 on Broadway. Do you think you remember the play?
Art.
It was Art. With, I think, Alan Alda and Victor Garber.
Correct.
Do I have it right?
Yes, you do.
And I think the show won the Best Play Tony.
Won Best Play.
And somebody won a Drama Desk.
Yeah, that was, I think I got the Drama Desk Award, Tony nomination. Who got it that year? It was wonderful, wonderful. Lovely actor who, anyway.
We can look it up. We'll find it.
But Anthony LaPaglia.
Oh, good.
Got it for View from the Bridge. And I saw that performance. It was absolutely stunning. Stunning performance.
So what happened at the end of the play, it's a 90, 95-minute play. It's a one act. Is that at that time you were doing probably the fundraising for Broadway Cares.
That's right, yeah.
And you came out on stage and you did your pitch.
Yeah, that's right.
You'd done the entire play as an American, and you came out and did your pitch as Alfred Molina. And there were gasps in the audience. It's like, oh my God, he's British.
That's right.
He must have been acting when he was doing that American accent.
The best remark I heard was one night when I heard someone gasp, and then I heard an older voice say, I thought he was Mexican. So it kind of confounded a lot of people, I think.
But what it was, even though it was a very odd way about it, they were recognizing that you were playing a character and doing an accent that was not your own, which I think in the odd way in which I'm telling the story is almost the highest praise you can get for performance, imagine you were somebody other than who you were.
Well, it didn't put people off. That's true. I mean, we raised quite a bit of money for the cause. But it was amusing because the three of us took turns to do the pitch at the end of each show, because the fundraising season on Broadway goes on for two or three weeks, so we all took turns. And whenever it was my turn, it always happened. There was always this kind of strange, kind of murmur and sort of a couple of sort of laughs or something like that. Which the very first time it happened was a little disconcerting.
But I might have been there that time.
But then I realized why it was that. I thought maybe my flies were undone or something, but it turns out it was just the novelty of the accent.
And I like the idea that you were confused for a Mexican. And that comes back to, I think it was a BBC executive said about 30 years ago that you were too ethnic to play British.
That's right, yeah, that's right.
What were the circumstances?
Right. I think I'd gone for an audition for a TV play or a TV movie for the BBC, and it was to play... I'd gone up for the part of a rather sort of, upper-class or middle-class British character. and I was told, you know, but you know, in that kind of wonderful sort of passive aggressive way that the British have, of paying you a compliment at the same time, sort of like cutting you off at the knees simultaneously. And he said something like, "Oh, you're a marvelous actor, Alfred, marvelous. But you know, you're just too ethnic." And this was a long time ago. I mean, this is not the kind of conversation that you would even dream of having now.
They wouldn't say it. They may think it, but I mean, they're not going to tell it to you, right?
But I mean, you know, when I first started acting, which was over 40 years ago, I remember being told by my first agent to drop the O at the end of my first name. You know, I was christened Alfredo, and I was told to drop the O because and his line was, "Drop the O, darling, because you'll be playing Spanish waiters all your life." And of course, at the time, I kind of went, "Oh, okay," and did it. But I mean, nowadays, I mean, can you imagine? I keep telling people, can you imagine some like Benicio del Toro's agent saying, "Let's make it kind of, let's call you Ben. Benny Bull. You know, how about Ben Bull?" You know, it just wouldn't happen now.
Yeah, thank goodness. Salma Hayek becomes Sally Hayek.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but this was like back in the mid-70s, so it was, you know, it was a different time.
Well, it was and it wasn't. I want to ask you about a couple early experiences in your life. I want to ask you about a teacher you had named Martin and what Martin told you and taught you, because I think it's an interesting lesson in about what it takes to become an actor and what it takes to hear as an aspiring actor that is helpful.
Yeah, well, Martin Corbett was his full name. He's now sadly passed away. But at the time, I was 11, about to start my first day at the big school, at secondary school, or what you guys would call high school, I guess.
Right.
And it was his first day as a teacher there. And he was almost exactly 20. I discovered later he was almost exactly 20 years older than me. And he started teaching. He was the deputy head of English or something like that. So one of the things he initiated was a drama club, which three or four of us were like totally into. And it gave me the confidence to confide in him and say that I wanted to be an actor. And Martin's response was basically, he said, "Well, if you're serious, I'll do everything I can to help you. But the minute you drop the ball, I'm washing my hands of it." You know, so he kind of gave me a challenge, which was, I'll be serious about this if you are. But the minute that I see you're not, then you can forget it. So he gave me plays to read. He gave me about a reading list. He told me about, you know, encouraged me to go to the school trips to the theater and see films. And it was a huge step, a huge development for me, because he was the first person in my life who really took me seriously about it. And so I was actually incredibly indebted to him. And I thanked him publicly many times, but he actually made the most amazing impact on me.
Well, what's interesting is what he didn't do is he didn't flatter you by saying, "You've got the gift, go with it." He said
quite the opposite.
He said, "If you want to do this, it's going to require work, and here's what it's going to require," which I think is a lesson that not a lot of people in any profession, let alone acting, hear.
He basically threw down the gauntlet and said, "You have to prove to me that you're serious about this." And I'll tell you another quick little footnote to that. Years later, while we were doing art on Broadway, Martin and his partner, by this time Martin had retired as a teacher, he came over to New York with his partner to see art. And I was terribly excited about that and very proud that, you know, he got the chance to see it. And he came to see the play, and it coincided with a trip. A friend of mine was there as well that night, happened to be there. So the three of us went out to dinner. And at some point over the dinner, my friend Andy said to Martin, "So, Martin, you know, you've known Fred since he was like 11. I mean, was he a good actor in those days?" And Martin, without dropping a beat, kind of went, "No, he was a terrible actor." But then he said, "But he was a wonderful show-off." And so I kind of thought, well, I must have just been so desperate to... And then he told me a story that he had to leave the classroom one day, and as he was on his way back, he overheard me doing a very bad impersonation of him. But I was getting lots of laughs. So he stayed in the doorway for a couple of minutes to kind of give me a chance to get my laughs before he came in.
It'd be funny if he came in and gave you notes, like on this one, like, yeah. Try a little bit more inflection here, and I don't roll my R's that way.
Yeah. He was a huge, huge part of my life.
So how many years later did you end up reading your sonnet, your Shakespeare sonnet, in poetry class? Were those kind of related events that you
it kind of coincided in the sense that he was our English master as well. So we would do, you know, we were following the curriculum as well, and there was a lot of Shakespeare in the curriculum and poetry and stuff. And so we would, and his style of teaching was very, very, you know, he got us all involved. You know, so we would read chunks from plays. We would read sonnets and so on and discuss them. And obviously there were some kids who couldn't be bothered, you know, but I was completely, I mean, when it came to the plays, I was completely enthralled. But here's the thing. Martin used to be and had been an actor himself, and he'd kind of retired from acting and become a teacher. So every now and again, when we'd be reading the plays, he would cast himself in sort of a nice juicy role and he would like start giving it some, and it was just brilliant. I mean, a lot of kids kind of found it amusing, but I was transfixed because, like, he was doing precisely what I wanted to do. So I loved it.
And then you memorized a Shakespearean sonnet
for
poetry class, right?
Yeah, we had to memorize sonnets and then kind of perform them. And then there were these, I can't remember, we used to do school plays at the end of term, but I think that was only like once or maybe twice a year. But there were these other performance evenings where a class would get up and do something in front of the school. It wasn't open to parents or anything. It was just for the school. And I think that involved sort of getting up and reading poetry and doing little kind of mime things and, you know, just little performance things like that, which, of course, you know, I loved all that.
When you are starting as an actor and you're young, there are certain things that motivate you and excite you and that you take pleasure from in terms of the performance. As you grow more experienced and it becomes a living, you're looking at, is the material any good? What's the venue like? Who are my co-stars? Who's directing this? Where does it fit into my schedule? Should I do one that's a comedy and one's a tragedy? Whatever. You're thinking much more strategically about how you're making a choice. But when you're thinking about the purest things that you enjoyed as an actor, when you didn't worry about those other things, are you able to retain some of that even to today?
Well, I guess you always try to. I mean, ultimately the joy is to be able to say that every job has been satisfying and fulfilling and so on. But
we know that's not true.
Of course it's not true. And in reality, you end up doing some things because you need the money or, you know, and so on. But I think the biggest difference between then and now is that I'm probably less inclined to work for nothing. Whereas, like, you know, 30, 40 years ago, I would have jumped to anything just for the chance to do it, you know. But I think there's – but I still, you know, but at my grand old age, I still get excited by a good script. I still get excited by the prospect of working with a new director that I don't know. I still get excited by the prospect of working in a new space that I don't know. You know, that all that kind of stuff is still, you know, it's still sort of energizing for me.
If you, which would be kind of mathematically likely, stumble upon yourself late at night while you're channel surfing, because there's a lot of roles of yours out there, do you stop and watch and say, that was pretty good, or what in the name of God was I thinking?
No, I try.
Or do you skip?
No, I try to skip. If I can, because when I have seen stuff that I did many, many years ago, I sort of, all I can see are the mistakes. All I can see is like, shouldn't have done that. You know, what a stupid face. Why was I pulling that face? Why didn't someone stop me? You know, I see flaws. I see missteps. And I mean, every now and again, there'll be like a scene where I'll think, yeah, I think that was pretty good. You know, I'll pat myself on the back occasionally, but more often than not, I'll kind of skip and go and watch something else.
When you are doing something, it could be a TV series, it could be a movie, it could be something on stage, do you know before the critics and the audience has weighed in if it's any good? Do you actually know the way in which it's going to be received? And is it often the case that what you think people will like, they don't, and what you think is in trouble is actually adored?
Well, this is where I'm going to sound really, really stupid, because I've got to be honest with you. Let's be honest. It's only the two of us, isn't it?
As far as I know.
I never really have a clue about whether. All I know is that I liked it. All I know is that I like the script. I like the people. I like the character. And I'll just go, you know, I'll just go hell for leather to kind of try and get it as right as I can. But I have no way of knowing, no way. And in fact, I once said to someone that I pride myself on recognizing a bad script, but I haven't always been smart enough to recognize a good script.
Meaning you have said no to things that have turned out to be good.
Yeah.
What would be on your regret list of things that you maybe had a chance to be?
I'm too much of a gentleman to even go there.
But the ones you said no to.
But the ones I've, you know, the ones I've, where I've, or perhaps I've read it and I've sort of said, you know, no, you know what, this isn't my cup of tea. Okay. And then it's taken someone else to say, read it again, look at it from this point of view, you know, and it's usually someone whose opinion I kind of respect, and I'll read it again. And sometimes it does change my view. But it's a skill to read. It's a skill to really be able to visualize what's particularly a film script or a TV script. Unless the director or the people involved have given you a really clear picture of what it's going to look like, what the tones are going to be, what the palette's going to be, what the style of shooting is going to be. If you don't know it, if you know all that, then you can make a much more educated guess.
Right.
But if all you're doing is reading it, I wouldn't rely on me to read a script.
No, and I think the danger is you put too much faith in what your gut is telling you, and your gut could be totally mistaken. I remember years ago, the actor George Clooney told me that he was looking at a...
As opposed to the plumber, George Clooney.
I guess that's true. Yes. Or the... How about the husband of the human rights advocate, George Clooney? Anyway, he's telling me the story about working with a first-time director. And he said, and I thought it was very interesting, he said that the mistake that a lot of actors make when they're working with a first-time director is they imagine the best possible version of that film. The thing that you have to do is imagine the worst possible version of that film and then say, do I still want to be in it?
Yeah, that's smart. That's
when you don't have the track record, you don't know what that actor is.
Well, that's good advice from the actor, George Clooney. But I'm curious to know what the plumber would have thought. No, but seriously.
It pays better than changing a pipe to it.
I think that's very good advice, and I think that's very smart. And I may well try and adopt that from now on before it's too late.
As you're thinking about the kinds of things that you want to do, is it a question of that appeals to me at this point in my career? Obviously, the nature of the roles are going to change because you're not 25 anymore. The nature of what you're going to be offered is going to change because of that. But does your criteria in terms of what you find challenging, what you find satisfying, what you feel you haven't done yet evolve? And does that lead you in different directions than it might have even just 10 years past?
That's a very complicated question. It requires three answers.
Okay.
The first one is... yes, things do change and criterias do change over time, obviously. When I was younger, my only criteria was to stay employed. That's the only thing that drove me, was to kind of keep working, keep making a living so I can pay my bills. And I basically said yes to everything. When I became a bit more kind of financially secure, a bit more relaxed, a bit more knowing that I'm feeling more confident that there would be work, I started then thinking in terms of, well, what if I've got a choice between this and this? Because it wasn't until I was well into my 40s that I ever was in a situation where I would have a choice between one job or the other. And when that happened, I then would choose something that would appeal to me for whatever reason. Now, I'm back to just saying yes to everything. Because
it all comes around.
Yeah, because basically
you've become Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, they're not writing sort of roles for 64-year-olds like every minute of the day. But you know, but the thing is what you do is you embrace where you're at. You know, I'm ready now to play judges and, you know, sort of quirky dads and granddads. I'm ready for that, you know.
Yeah, but if David Thewlis can play a superhero in Wonder Woman, anything is possible, right?
I guess. But then you have to be as good as David Thewlis.
Ah, who's to say who's better and who's worse? But that idea of when it is that you can say no is a fascinating concept. Because I think for a lot of actors, the moment that they realize that they can say no to an offer is a turning point in his or her career. Because it means you don't have to do it. You don't need the money. You can choose what is best for your career as compared to, say, what is best to put food on the table because you don't have to worry about that.
I happen to agree with you, but there are a lot of actors who would disagree and say that power comes from being able to say no from the get-go, that having that kind of confidence creates a sort of energy for you, creates a kind of... But I was never that brave. I never had the gumption to kind of turn... You know, if I'd been out of work for a couple of months and this job comes, I just never had the gumption to say, you know what, I'm going to stay out of work for another couple of months because I think there's something better coming around the pipe. I was never able to think that way.
But I think it's the nature of being an artist, and being an artist in a field where there are 100 people for every possible job, and that you're at least an actor. If you're Philip Glass tells this great story of writing music and not giving up his day job, which was either installing plumbing, not with the plumber George Clooney, or driving a cab. And there's a story he tells about picking up a patron outside of Lincoln Center where his music was being performed, and the person got in the cab and said, "It's very funny. You have the same name as the composer whose music I just heard." And he said, "It's me. I am Philip Glass. That is my music." But he wouldn't give up the job because he didn't have the security to know that he could make it. I admire that.
I think that's fantastic.
I don't think he's still driving a cab now.
I don't think so, no. Have you seen the size of his townhouse? I don't think so.
Yes. I want to ask you about, you know, certain roles you play, and I was really curious about playing the film director Robert Aldrich in The Feud, a series about Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. When you play a creative person and go back and research his or, I guess it's her, not her life, but his life because you're a male actor, when you go back and look at the life of a creative person that you're playing, how is that different from playing a fictional character or an historical person who isn't in the arts? What do you learn about filmmaking or directing through a story like that?
Well, I think the first thing is that the difference between playing a fictional character and a person who actually existed or does exist, either historically or contemporaneously, is that there's a certain amount of research and homework involved so as not to misrepresent that person. Now, to what extent you go into that process is very much depends A on what's required in the text or what's required in the project, and also what your own taste is. I mean, you know, I remember there was a great deal of fuss made when Dan Day-Lewis went off and sort of, you know, spent 6 months learning how to make shoes in Florence or something, you know, for a role, and, you know, wouldn't come out of character, that's great. I wouldn't do that, but that's great. You know, that was great for him, and he's got 3 Oscars to show for it. So that maybe he was onto something.
Maybe that's the difference. You know? Become a cobbler, and Oscars will follow.
So, you know, but I think essentially it's just about not misrepresenting the person that you're portraying, and that's what I did with Robert. You know, I read everything I could about him. I watched all the movies that were available of his, just to get a sense of him and what he was like, and then of course marrying that to the requirements of the text, because after all we're not making a documentary about,
right.
We weren't making a documentary about these characters. We were making a fictional rendering of a very iconic group of people. So I think there is a certain responsibility. Yeah. Whereas, you know, when you're playing a fictional character, you're very much kind of up to, you know, Anthony Hopkins said something really fantastic once about that, and he kind of said, you know, the same thing, that if you're playing a real person, you do your homework, but if you're playing a fictional character, all you're required to bring is your imagination. That's what they're paying you for, to use your imagination.
And do you find one more challenging or satisfying than the other, fictional versus real?
Well, personally, I enjoy the homework. I mean, right. I find that responsibility quite energizing and just interesting. I mean, I love to read. I'm a bit of a history buff. I love to find out things about people. So that process for me is very enjoyable. But it all really boils down to, is the character someone that you see yourself as, someone that you can see yourself playing, you know, and that really has nothing to do whether they're real or fictional.
But when you look into somebody like Robert Aldrich, what does it teach you about the way Hollywood used to operate and the rules under which he made movies versus today?
Yeah, well, I think the big difference, and this was a big theme in the miniseries, was how we like to flatter ourselves that things have changed, but actually they haven't that much.
Not so much.
You know, I mean, there's what I loved about the way it was dealt with in Feud was, for instance, the scene when Alison Wright's character, Pauline, confides in Robert that she has a script that she's written and that she'd like to try and direct. And he says that'll never happen. Women don't direct movies. But he didn't say it as a put down.
So it's just not the way it is.
It's just not the way it is. You know, he said it like he was saying, you know, water's wet. You know, it's just a fact. And I think that was a much more interesting way to deal with that moment than, say, have him come on all kind of right. male and patronizing. It's just that was just the truth of that time.
You mentioned Daniel Day-Lewis, and it reminds me of a story that a sound recorder told about the making of There Will Be Blood. There's a scene involving bowling pins in There Will Be Blood. If you haven't seen the movie, you know this. It involves bowling pins and violence. And the sound recordist was doing, you know, some actual kind of secondary pickups of what it sounded like bowling pins hitting the wall. Daniel Day-Lewis was in his trailer. He'd wrapped for the day. And he heard that this was happening. So he came down to the stage and said, I have to be throwing the bowling pins. The sound recordist said, but we don't see you. It's just sound recorded. He said, my character is throwing the bowling pins, so I need to throw the bowling pins. Sound recordist said, fine. Daniel Day-Lewis said, and I have to be in costume. So they brought out the costume, and they got him dressed, and he threw the bowling pins. Now, there is a level of dedication to acting that describes that might be a little bit on the far side of maniacal. But I'm wondering, as you're working with other actors and seeing the levels to which actors do and do not go to be prepared, where would you put yourself on that spectrum? How much is too much? And do you see a lot of younger actors not putting in the homework that requires them to understand what it is they're doing?
Yeah. Well, I personally wouldn't agree with your premise that it's nudging the far side of maniacal. I think anything that actors need to do, as long as it's not illegal or dangerous to anyone else, I think is fair game. You know, whatever actors, you know, whatever performers need to achieve in order to feel that they're doing their job is okay with me. I think there is a danger of actors getting a little lazy and just turning up and just kind of phoning it in, as we used to say. I've seen that. I've witnessed that as well, and that's not very pleasant because you kind of feel. I personally always feel a little bit let down by that. But in terms of actors pushing themselves and to achieve something, you know, like the example of Dan sort of doing all that stuff, that's all fair game because it's not. It's purely to do with giving them. I'm assuming this. I'm just presuming that it's to do with giving them a confidence and a sense of ownership that is very, very important.
I think that's absolutely true. And it's like you can do it right or you don't do it at all.
But where I would put myself on that spectrum, I don't know. I think it depends. It depends on what's required because I think, you know, this is the thing about actors that I always find kind of a bit bemusing because we give ourselves so much jargon about, you know, being in the moment and being present and available. We use all these buzzwords that come out of some kind of, you know, psychoanalysis or something. And basically it boils down to, and I'll tell you a quick story. When I was doing Red, the play.
On Broadway?
On Broadway. The audience come in, and my character, I'm already sitting on stage. I've been there before anyone else comes in. So as the audience come in, they see me on stage. It was a rainy, one of those summer, rainy, showery afternoons, and they let the audience in early. And there was an elderly couple sitting in the front row, right just behind my chair, which was way downstage. And I heard the lady say, "There's somebody in the chair." And I heard the gentleman say, "Yeah, that's Alfred Molina. He's playing Rothko." And the lady said, "What's he doing in the chair?" And the guy said, "Getting in the mood."
Are you half tempted to turn around and
go? I wanted to turn around and had I been wearing a hat, I think I would have tipped it. It was brilliant because that's exactly what we do. We just get in the mood. We give ourselves all this kind of self-aggrandizing kind of jargon about it. But basically, that's it. We spend our time finding ways to get in the mood.
I want to ask you about, you know, you mentioned Robert Aldrich and telling a woman that she couldn't direct a film, which is probably what happens very much still to the day. But I want to ask you about two movies that I think are interesting bookends to a different look at a similar issue. One is Stephen Frears' movie Prick Up Your Ears from 1987. The other one is Ira Sachs' film Love is Strange.
Yeah.
Because I think they're interesting portraits of what it does and does not mean to be in a gay relationship and how much has and has not changed in those intervening years.
Yeah. Well, I think that's very interesting. What are they, 30-something years apart? More than that, maybe. The difference, I think, is actually multi-layered, because when we did Prick Up Your Ears, we were all very young, and it was very new territory for films. Stephen Frears had just done My Beautiful Laundrette with Dan Day-Lewis, which was a real groundbreaking movie in terms of what it was showing in terms of gay politics and gay sex. Then he followed it up with Prick Up Your Ears, which had a historical context. But it was about a couple, a relationship that was happening before homosexuality was decriminalized in the UK, before the Wolfenden Report in 67. So it had a completely different tone to anything that's happened since. It was kind of groundbreaking in the sense that it was about two real men who had been in this kind of sort of codependent and ultimately violent relationship, deadly relationship. And then 30-odd years later, the same actor, oddly enough, is, you know, grown up, middle-aged, and is now in what you could describe as a grown-up relationship. And the difference, I think, in what's happened in society was beautifully kind of captured in those two bookends, that, you know, we're now... Still, things aren't perfect by any means. I don't think any of my gay friends would thank me if I said, "Oh, things are so much better now. Everything's fine now," because they're not. But there seems to be a societal shift that has made it certainly easier. You know, gay men and women can get married with all the complexities that still exist. But I think it's interesting that Prick Up Your Ears was about a relationship that was dysfunctional. And it was assumed that all gay relationships were dysfunctional. Right. And then Love is Strange is about a relationship that's so normal that it's almost banal in its ordinariness. There's nothing in that relationship between John's character and mine that could not apply to a straight couple. You know, and I think that movement, that development, that is quite startling.
No, and I would say, too, since we're talking about theater, there's a show at the Wallace Annenberg right now, The Pride, which is very much about that and the way in which things have and have not evolved in, you know, it's probably more of a 60-year time period in that play. Speaking of theater, I want to ask you about the show you did at the Geffen, the feel-good comedy Long Day's Journey Into Tonight.
That little wacky little boulevard comedy.
How does a... choice to do a show like that come about? You did it with a good friend of yours, Jane Kaczmarek.
Yep.
Is it the right place, the right time, the right script? Who is the tail and who is the dog that's doing the wagging?
Well, it depends who you talk to. If you spoke to Jane,
talking to you, so right, I want to hear your version.
Well, I think I may have been the tail being wagged. I think, but anyway, what happened was that Jane and I have become friends, and we met doing a radio play, and we had a wonderful time doing it, and we said, we should do this again, and so...
But meant it, as opposed to everybody in Hollywood saying, let's do lunch, let's do it again,
fuck
you.
No, we really, yeah, exactly, we really kind of, I mean, I felt like I really found a sort of a co-conspirator in a way, you know, someone who, you know, I get her sensibilities, she gets mine, we've always, you know, we always enjoyed working together. And we did a couple of radio plays. We then did a wonderful play called And No More Shall We Part at the Williamstown Theatre Festival last summer, 2016. And then while we were doing that, we were thinking about what should we do next? What would be the next thing we could do? And then we reconvened back home here in LA, and we started talking about plays, you know, and we would say, look, you know, we're both actors in our 60s. You know, let's start looking at something that's kind of appropriate for us. And Long Day's Journey Into Night was top of the list because it's like, it's a it's a mountain of a play. And you know, you look at certain plays and you kind of go, if I don't have a go at doing this play before I die, I'm going to be really pissed off with myself.
I can see your tombstone. Alfred Molina never got around to Long Way's Journey.
Exactly. Yeah, missed out on Hamlet. But then we had a whole list of other plays, and which we danced around. And eventually we realized we were just circling the
same. You're just putting off the inevitable. Yeah.
And then we just kind of decided to do it. And we found a theater. And luckily, Jane and I, we have reputations that are good enough that theaters gave us, you know, were able to trust us that we were going to, you know, at least turn up. And then that's how it evolved. And it was a play that we were both wanted to do. I think Jane told me she'd done the play before.
In college, I think.
Yeah, but she was way, way too young.
A little bit too young.
You know, and I'd played Edmund before. As a very young actor. So it was kind of, it was one of those things. It was like about time, you know, about time we had a go at this, you know, sort of some grown-up stuff.
I'm going to ask you this last question about acting. You have done a lot of television. You've done a lot of film, a lot of theater. When you're doing a radio play, you lose pretty much everything you have as a tool as an actor. You lose the eyebrows, the eyes that I'm looking at, you're raising your eyes right now, the hand gestures, the body language, yourself in relation to another actor. And all you have is your voice. When you're doing a radio play, consciously or unconsciously, how much of all of your training leads up to setting aside everything that you have learned to use to your advantage and only using your voice?
Well, in a weird sort of way, it's easier because you're focusing everything into the microphone. Every piece of information that you're wanting the audience to kind of pick up on is coming through just one medium in a sense. But because it's so focused just on the voice, the audience, the listening audience, they've all got that play going on in their heads. So the audience's imagination is filling in all the stuff that we're not doing. They're imagining us there. So every single listener has a unique version of the play going on in their head. So in a sense, it's not that you suddenly start trying to do everything with your voice, you know, to somehow make it work. No, you still do it the way you would. You know, it still has to be authentic. And I try and avoid using the word real because there's nothing real about what we do, but authentic and believable. So it's not really a matter of making the voice do the work of all the other elements. It's just making the voice do its work as clearly and as succinctly as possible.
And I would say along those same lines that the best movie version of any of the Harry Potter novels outside of Alfonso Cuarón's Prisoner of Azkaban is Jim Dale reading the books for Books on Tape, because his performance is as cinematic and as captivating and sparks the imagination in ways that I think very few of the feature films do.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen all the Harry Potters. I've only seen the first one. It's a terrible gap in my film education. But I've heard Jim's recordings, and you're right. I mean, it's just – but he's a fantastic actor, and clearly his love of the material just shines through, because you couldn't do that kind of performance if you were sort of feeling so-so about what you're reading.
So people who want to know more about you, I think they should do a double feature, Prick Up Your Ears to begin and Love is Strange to end, just because I think they're interesting companion stories.
Yeah, it's an interesting pair of films, actually.
The weeks and months to come ahead, if you're traveling in London, say, next year, what should they look for you doing? Where are you going to be?
We don't know the theater yet, but sometime in the spring, we're remounting the original production of Red. In London, in the West End, same director, same actor, plus one other. We don't quite know yet which theatre it's going to be.
And some films, some TV series?
Yeah, there's a couple of films that are still waiting to be released. A movie called Breakable You, which stars Tony Shalhoub and Holly Hunter, with me sort of coming up behind, doing my best to wave. And a film called Message from the King, that Chadwick Boseman is starring in. Really fantastic kind of murder mystery thriller.
Alfred Molina is an actor and producer, and he has been our guest on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Alfred, thanks so much for taking the time.
This has been such a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
In order to feel comfortable that you're getting a fair price, you need pricing context, information that empowers you to feel confident. With TrueCar, you'll see what other people in your local market paid for the car that you want. And from there, you can connect with a local TrueCar certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want, and TrueCar will show you what other people in your area paid for the car you want. Now you know what a fair price is, and you can feel confident. Once you register, you'll see real pricing on actual inventory. This is competitive pricing offered to you only by a TrueCar certified dealer for an actual vehicle on their lot. It's pricing that you'll see before going to a dealership, so you can feel confident when you show up. And with TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing, so you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with their TrueCar certified dealers, and TrueCar users save an average of more than $3,000 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
Hey guys, it's Richard Blaze.
And I'm Jasmine Blaze.
Listen, we got a new show coming out every week with Podcast One. It's called Starving for Attention. Get an entertaining, behind-the-scenes look at the world of food with me, chef, television personality, and author.
And I'm here to make sure he behaves himself and doesn't make up any words.
I make up lots of words. And we're going to be talking to anyone and everyone in the culinary industry, including restaurateurs, television hosts, famous chefs, producers of your favorite cooking and competition shows, and more. Here's some spontaneous back-of-house conversation about what it takes to make it in different parts of the food business, global trends, and where the industry overlaps with entertainment.
Plus, play along with our games, trivia, and other wacky moments.
You're going to get hungry for more or possibly terrified to go to restaurants. Either way, we're going to have some fun.
Whether you like it or not.
Pull up a seat every Tuesday on PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
That was Alfred Molina on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. And if you like what you heard, you can check out past episodes with guests like Bryan Cranston, Rainn Wilson, and Josh Gad. And while you're enjoying more from Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or at PodcastOne.com. And don't forget to rate, review, and share. I'm John Horn. We'll see you next week on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Download new episodes every Wednesday at PodcastOne.com, on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at iTunes.